Grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Hi, this is Jay Pierce, station manager of WILL Radio. In less than a week, the U.S. House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. This cut would be devastating to WILL. Many of you have called your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. If you haven't done so, we hope you will soon. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, call us at 217-333-1070 or visit our website, will.uiuc.edu. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thanks.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we present an interview from the archives from May 18th of this year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll look at Rwanda in the aftermath of the genocide of 1994 that resulted in the deaths of more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Our guest is journalist Dina Temple Raston. She is the author of Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. The killing took place over the course of 100 days. What happened at the end of those 100 days of horror? Where is Rwanda today, 11 years after the genocide? Those are the questions Temple Raston takes up in her book, Justice on the Grass. Dina Temple Raston is also the author of A Death in Texas. That book was about the 1998 murder of James Burr Jr. in Jasper, Texas. An African-American, he was brutally murdered by three young white men. The book was chosen by the Washington Post as one of the best books of 2002. It was also awarded the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Prize of 2002 for nonfiction. Our guest, Dina Temple Raston, is currently City Hall Bureau Chief for the New York Sun. Her new book, Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption, is published by the Free Press. Dina Temple Raston, good afternoon. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Talk with us, first of all, about the title of the book, what it refers to, Justice on the Grass.
Well, the book really looks at sort of the overarching justice system that they reconstructed in Rwanda to try and make people accountable for what happened during the genocide. And Justice on the Grass comes from a Kinyarwanda word called gachacha, which were these open-air tribal courts that they resurrected to try and get some of the 120,000 people who were accused and in prison of taking part in the genocide, trying to get them through the system.
Yeah, and was justice done? Did justice come close to being done?
Not always. I mean, I suppose that is what sort of the book is about, is the imperfect justice that had to take place when you have something that is as horrible as a genocide that kills 800,000 people in 100 days. They had essentially three court systems. They had the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which was supposed to try the masterminds of the genocide. And then in addition to that, they had sort of the Rwandan system, which is basically all the judges and all the lawyers were killed during the genocide, so they had to rebuild it from scratch. And then they had the Gacaca system, which was really like a community court trying to find a way to piece the community back together again.
Yeah, and go back to that idea of the grass. There is a chapter in the book, When Two Elephants Fight. It is the grass that suffers.
Right.
The trial of the journalist, does it stand in for the imperfect justice that was meted out, that has been meted out?
Yes. I mean, what was interesting about the trial and the reason why I started writing the book was because not since Nuremberg has an international court taken a look at the role of journalists in mass violence. And the radio station in Rwanda really did foment the violence that was going on there. So I wanted to see how responsible the journalists who were who worked at the radio station and helped found it, how responsible they would be found. I mean, it's interesting in the context of what's been going on with this Newsweek article. Under the precedent that was set for the International Criminal Court with these Rwandan journalists, Newsweek could be found guilty of incitement because of its article, erroneous article about the Quran being flushed down the toilet and people who died in Afghanistan as a result.
Yeah. In the end, you say that the tribunal massaged and stretched the definition of incitement.
Yes. The reason being that the International Criminal Court for Rwanda, this is a UN court, is actually under sort of the thumb of President Kagame, the president of Rwanda. And if he doesn't give his people visas, if he doesn't allow investigators to come into his country, basically the International Criminal the ICTR, as it is known, can do very little. And the three men that they found and wanted to hold responsible for what the radio station did, and the radio station called for Hutu to go out and kill Tutsi and said, you know, kill the cockroaches, they'll kill you if you don't kill them. It actually became almost a military communication system. So clearly the radio station was wrong, but the only three people that they could find still alive after the genocide who had something to do with the radio station were these three men that they tried. And in order to find them guilty, they really had to stretch the parameters because there wasn't enough evidence on the face of it to find them guilty of incitement to genocide.
Yeah. And the prosecutor, it seems he set out. What was his...
Well,
motivation. It seems that he set out to actually go after journalists in a way.
Yes, I mean, and some of the judges too thought that it was about time, given that the last person who was in the docket, the last journalist who was in a docket for these kinds of crimes was Julius Streicher during the Second World War, the self-described number one Nazi who had the anti-Semitic newspaper Der Stürmer. They felt that the media had changed so much in the intervening years that there really needed to be a new standard set for what was permissible, what was protected speech, and what wasn't. And this case set out to do just that.
Yeah. Do you think this trial will have the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in the journalist's case will have an impact on American media?
I don't know if it will have an. It would depend. If America were to actually sign on to the International Criminal Court, then this precedent would actually apply to Americans as well. And having seen what, again, happened with the Newsweek article and the violence that was incited, even though the article ended up being erroneous, they would be a prime example of the type of American journalist who could be held responsible.
Hmm. Your book focuses on what happened once the killing stopped, but you also look at what happened and why it happened. And I think it would be helpful to take a look at Rwanda's history and maybe go all the way back to a fellow by the name of John Hanning Speke.
Jonathan Hanning Speke was one of the two sort of explorers that we probably know most about in East Africa. It was Richard Burton and Jonathan Hanning Speke, and they had a race to find the source of the Nile. And as he was writing for the British Explorers Society, or their, I think it's the Geographical Society in London, he had come across some lighter-skinned Africans there in East Africa. And they seemed to have a king, and they seemed to have some sort of form of government. And this was problematic, as a slave trade was just, this is in the early 1800s, 1830 or so, and the slave trade was really sort of getting going, and they needed a some sort of excuse for why they could go ahead with the slave trade and to call black Africans subhuman. Well, if they had a government and if they had a king, then it was very, very hard to call them subhuman. So Speke decided instead that what he would do is he would decide that these lighter-skinned black Africans really weren't black Africans at all. They were descendants of the Hamitic tribe, and it went on to say they were the descendants of Ham. And he made up, out of thin air, this thing called the Hamitic theory, which basically said that there was a lower rung of Africans and a higher rung of Africans, and these Africans with thinner noses and who were taller and had lighter skin were of a higher order of African. And the Rwandan genocide, if you want to trace it all the way back, began at that point.
Yeah. The Tutsi were set up as elite and the Hutu less.
As the servants. I mean, the word Hutu in Kinyarwanda actually means slave. So it was the difference between Hutu and Tutsi. We often think of Hutu and Tutsi as being two different tribes. Well, they're not. They're descendants of the same tribe, and they have the same language. They have the same religion, which is Catholicism, and the same culture. So really the only differences they had were caste, really, because you could buy 10 cows, and you could be short and dark and Hutu. But if you bought 10 cows, you could be designated a Tutsi. And it was a very sort of free system in which you could move between the two different castes quite easily until the Belgians came to Rwanda and decided to formalize the system. They wanted to put the Tutsi in charge because they were a minority and would be easily controlled. So they actually took out calipers and measured somebody's nose. And if your nose was so thick or so thin, if it was thin, you were designated a Tutsi, and if it was thick, you were designated a Hutu, and then they passed out cards. And that's when the moment where it became a very formalized system that someone was either Hutu or Tutsi and couldn't move between the two groups.
Yeah, national identity cards going back to the 20s.
Right.
1920s.
And if you remember that in Hotel Rwanda or sometimes in April or any movie you've seen about Rwanda during the genocide, when they come to a roadblock, Rwandans have to show them a card. And if their card said Tutsi, they were killed at the roadblock. And if their card said Hutu, they were let pass.
Hmm. You're careful to point out that prejudice was not at the root of the genocide, however. You say it was a competition for resources. Talk about that.
Well, Rwanda is a very poor country, and it's the most crowded country in Africa. And there's not a lot of natural resources there. I mean, they grow coffee and tea, but it's not like some African countries where they have diamonds or minerals or something that can sustain the economy. So really what ended up happening is that the Tutsi became the unfortunate casualties of a power struggle. And the Hutu, who were 85% of the population, figured that if they killed all of the Tutsi, then there would be more room for them and the competition for resources would stop.
Mm. How do Rwandans talk about what happened?
A little matter-of-factly, actually, which has always sort of stunned me. Even when they're talking, even if it's a Tutsi talking about the killing and the number of people who in their families who died, they sort of numbly tell you. They're not an exceedingly demonstrative people, and they'll sort of numbly tell you what happened. And if they're accused of killing, if they're Hutu and they're accused of killing, they always say they never did it. But if you ask them, you know, what was the one thing you were around during the genocide? What was the one thing that you kept seeing? Or what was the most striking image? They rarely would come up with one. They said, no, it was just a difficult time, and sort of wave you off. Most of the information that I got was actually from women who had been gang raped during the genocide, because they were willing to talk about their children and how they were dealing with the problem of rearing a child that came out of a gang rape.
Yeah. How do they deal with that?
That's the question.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the children have been sent off to relatives because the women can't handle it. A lot of the women have HIV or AIDS because on purpose during the genocide, the Hutu army picked out the men who were HIV positive and told them to rape the Tutsi women so that they would, it's translated to die slowly of sadness. And so there are now a lot of women in Rwanda that have full-blown AIDS or have children who are just showing signs of HIV AIDS, and there's very little medicine for them.
Hmm. It was so systematically done, wasn't it?
It's known as the most efficient killing ever. If you think 800,000 people in 100 days, and then the other sort of little wrinkle there is it's not 800,000 people with machine guns and grenades and big weapons. It's 800,000 people killed with farm tools, so with clubs and machetes and with hoes and that sort of thing. And that's what they were killed with. And the killers would go to sleep at night and stop killing because they couldn't lift their arms anymore. They were too tired.
Now, the massacre that began in April of 1994 was not the first of the 1990s. What should we know about the massacre in 1992? And you can correct my pronunciation here, Bugesera.
The Bugesera massacre was, and it was a small one, but all the same, the reason why it happened in Bugesera is they basically wanted to see if they could test a genocide, have a tester genocide there. And so what they ended up doing was sending in troops and killing a bunch of Tutsi and then finding out whether or not anybody would react. And, of course, no one did. And it gave them the idea that they could kill with impunity.
Mm. Guernica and Armenia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, did anyone at the time recognize Bugesera as the test massacre?
Mostly just human rights officials who were actually in Rwanda, who and homegrown human rights officials who were asking, diplomats there to come and look at the killing fields of Bugesera to show that something was brewing beneath the surface, that there was more tension than anybody was willing to admit.
And one of those people was a woman by the name of Monique Mujawamira?
Yes, that's good. Monique, actually, she was one of the few human rights activists in Rwanda before the genocide. And one of the things that sort of made her famous was that she was willing to face off the government of President Habyarimana and would say, this killing is occurring here, Tutsi are disappearing there. Well, they tried to actually kill her by running her car off the road, and they were unsuccessful in actually killing her, but really sort of damaged her badly. And in bandages, she ended up greeting all these diplomats who were coming to look at the Bugesera killing, and she took them around. And then afterwards, she ended up going to the White House for the 40th anniversary of the Geneva Convention and met Bill Clinton there and hung onto his hand and kept saying to him, look, you need to come. Things are going wrong in Rwanda. We need your help. And this was months before the genocide began. And when the genocide did actually begin, President Clinton's chief concern in Rwanda was, where was Monique? And that was the question that he kept asking in the morning when he was getting his security briefing, is, where's Monique? Where's Monique? And when they finally found Monique, he seemed to have lost interest in what was going on in Rwanda.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Dina Temple Raston, author of Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Where is Monique today?
She's actually in Canada, and she's remarried, and she has started a foundation that basically tries to bring different African children together from different tribes to meet each other and to try and understand what their differences and commonalities are.
Hmm. And is any of that work taking place in Rwanda?
Some of it is, but she's considered persona non grata in Rwanda now.
Yeah. What do Rwandans say about how they got along with one another before the genocide?
And that's a great question. That question was actually the reason why I ended up writing the book. My first book about Jasper, Texas, was about basically a white-on-black racism. And I wanted to see if there was a difference between white-on-black racism and black-on-black prejudice. So I went to Rwanda, and I was in this banana grove in this small town called Mblezi. And the sum total of the Tutsi population that was left after the genocide was sitting before me, and we were talking to them about how life in the village was before the genocide. So there were five people before me. 250 Tutsi had previously lived in this small village. And I said, how did you guys get along, you know, before the genocide? And Hutu and Tutsi. And Clavier Twizmana, who was one of the small characters in the book, said to me, well, actually, you know, we all got along all right, but we always knew that they were prejudiced. The Hutu were prejudiced. And what struck me about this was that was word for word what somebody in the black community in Jasper had told me when I asked them how were relations between whites and blacks before the James Byrd murder in 1998.
Hmm. It's also interesting to me to see how you experienced the Kigali Memorial Center. How is the genocide spoken about, remembered there?
Right. Yeah, the Kigali Memorial Center is very interesting because it was actually built by Aegis Trust, which is a sort of British foundation. And so they actually wrote everything there. So it's how Rwandans see the genocide as interpreted by somebody who was British. And there are two sides to the genocide now. There is the way the Hutu view the genocide and the way the Tutsi view the genocide. And after the genocide stopped in July of 1994, there were a lot of reprisal killings, and that shouldn't be a big surprise. Tutsi were getting even with Hutu, who had killed family members or whom they thought had killed family members. So tens of thousands of Hutu were killed in these reprisal killings, and nobody ever talked about them. And when they tried to get some sort of compensation or to get somebody convicted for these killings, they wouldn't allow that to happen. The Tutsi government that was running Rwanda, Paul Kagame's government, said, no, we're talking about genocide, we're not talking about reprisal killings. So as a result, what you have is a real split in the way the genocide is actually viewed. I think most Tutsi think of it as stopping in July when the genocide actually stopped, and Hutu see the genocide as having repercussions and ripples way beyond that. So, for example, you can always tell whether or not this is a government-backed project in Rwanda if the number of people killed is more than a million killed in 100 days. Because the government has an interest in having the number be as high as possible. And most independent organizations, Human Rights Watch, that sort of thing, put the number probably closer between 500,000 and 800,000. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to Hutu, they continually point to this more than a million number as proof that everything has to be seen now through a Tutsi lens as opposed to a Hutu lens.
Yeah, and it seems so sadly we're back, in a way, then, to 1992 and 1994.
Exactly. And in the end, that's one of the big conclusions of the book, is that those building blocks of genocide really haven't changed at all in Rwanda. I mean, before it was a Hutu government, and now it's a Tutsi government, so everything has basically been slipped on its face. So where the Hutu used to be in power, now the Tutsi are in power. Where the Tutsi used to feel disenfranchised, now the Hutu feel disenfranchised. But the problem now is that the majority feels disenfranchised, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. The 2003 election?
Yes.
What kind of campaign was that? Who were the candidates? How did that unfold?
Well, I used to be a White House correspondent, and so I've been on quite a number of campaigns. I went on two of President Clinton's campaigns and Al Gore's campaign as well. So what I decided is to insinuate myself into Paul Kagame's campaign sort of apparatus and get into his campaign van and campaign with him in much the same way that I had done in the United States and cover that campaign. And clearly it was very different. And there were two candidates. Well, there were five candidates, but essentially there were two candidates for the Rwandan presidency. And this was their first so-called multi-party elections. And Paul Kagame, who had been sort of the caretaker president up to that point, called the elections 3 months before they were going to happen and set the actual date for the election only about 4 weeks before it actually happened. And so he had this whole apparatus, and he knew that there was going to be an election coming. And anybody else who wanted to run against him, these so-called multi-party elections, were caught unawares. There was a moderate politician in Rwanda during the genocide who barely escaped with his life, named Faustin Twagiramungu. He'd been living in Belgium for some time, and he decided to come back and actually run against Paul Kagame for the presidency because he had the name recognition and people knew that he was a good guy during the genocide. So there was almost a total news blackout for anything on Paul Kagame, Twagiramungu, Paul Kagame's sort of opponent. And I went into his so-called campaign van as well, and while Kagame had vans and T-shirts and umbrellas and flags and everything that you would expect from, you know, a real live American campaign, Twagiramungu had none of this. He had to borrow a friend's car to drive himself from rally to rally. And very often, sort of Kagame thugs would show up and break up Twagiramungu rallies so nobody could come and see him and hear him speak. Needless to say, Paul Kagame ended up winning the presidency with 98.7% of the vote.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this caller in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm calling as an African, and not an African-American, but as an African. And as you can hear, your phones are not even ringing off the hook here. Nobody seems to give a care about what's going on in Africa and Rwanda, since politically and economically, there is not much going on. And I step Hutus and the Tutsi problem, but I have an American wife, and trying to explain the whole, how the Belgians and also even took it out of British in Nigeria, how they pitted one group against another, was something that was difficult for her to understand, and saying, okay, now, 50 years later, 100 years later, why is there a problem? But I think some of those things, if we can look at Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina as issues that have not been resolved because of how different sides were pitted against each other. And unfortunately, if there is not I'm a little bit skeptical, if there is not an economic or something economic for the West to look at, it doesn't seem to really be number one on the news or in the newspapers.
Well, and that's one of the problems with writing a book about Africa, actually. Although I have to say that I thought things changed, not because we've come much more enlightened, because the interest changed is war on terror. Mm-hmm. And specifically what I'm thinking of is Darfur. And mm-hmm. I had gone to Darfur for the newspaper I work for in New York about a year ago, last May. Mm-hmm. And when it started making the newspapers that there was this problem in Sudan, I was really kind of amazed how quickly the Bush administration responded. And I think that, now, while they haven't sent troops, for sure, mm-hmm. at least Colin Powell went. And yeah. He went when it was still a problem. And he went only months, like a couple of months, after it started really hitting the newspapers that this horrible thing was happening in Darfur. And I'm convinced the reason why he went is because the Bush administration, and I think administrations from now on, are very frightened of failed states now. Before, we could let states fail and we didn't worry about it. But now failed states become sort of a safe haven for terrorism.
Yeah.
And Sudan, if you remember, where was Osama bin Laden before he was in Afghanistan? He was in Sudan. And it was pressure the U.S. put on the Khartoum government to expel him that got him to Afghanistan in the first place.
Yeah. And I think, it's still about self-interest rather than the interest of the people that have been affected by whatever is going on there. I mean, the Christian South versus the Muslim North, and and nobody's really, I mean, looking at those larger issues. Yes, Sudan now is maybe the Christian South is going to have some semi-self-governance, but
right.
It's still, I find it difficult to explain to the, unfortunately, to the average American about how those issues came to be in the partition of Africa and how different groups have been pitted against one another in order to make governments, at least during the colonial era, work. And now, 50 years after the colonialism is gone, there's still some big things that have been left behind that are still causing problems in many countries.
Right.
Today.
Right.
But I'm glad that you're on the radio, and maybe one or two other people would listen and say something and buy your book and get people thinking about the whole issue, that it's not just about America and the West, that there are other countries out there that we are affected. As long as we're human, we are affected by what's going on.
That's right. That's right.
But thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. So recommend the book, Justice on the Grass, by our guest, Dina Temple Raston. One of the things that puzzles me, and I guess it remains a mystery, is some of the events leading up to the genocide. There were two assassinations. The lynching of the head of the National Hutu Party, the Coalition for the Defense of the Republic, the CDR,
right.
who are, I don't know if the party still exists, stridently anti-Tutsi.
Who were, yeah, they no longer exist.
Okay. And then in April, the shooting down of the president's plane. And it seems that we don't know who's responsible for those murders?
No. And the first one is a little bit more obscure than the second, clearly. The first, I mean, in either case, you can make a pretty good argument for Hutu or Tutsi doing it. I mean, the CDR, the anti-Tutsi party, it's very possible that the Hutu power movement wanted to stir up Hutu and show them that the Tutsi really were the enemy, so they killed the leader. Or the Tutsi could have done it because they were frightened of him. Similarly, if you listen to French investigations, they will tell you that it is the Tutsi that shot President Habyarimana's plane out of the sky in April 1994. And the Tutsi have always claimed that the Hutu did it because they were angry that he had signed a power-sharing agreement that would have given power to the Tutsi. Whatever it was, or whoever did it, it was the perfect example of how you just take an event and then help it spiral into something bigger. And the radio station RTLM, within minutes of hearing that the plane was shot down, said the Tutsi have killed our president. And it got a lot of people angry.
Yeah. Also, early that year, government forces were recruiting a militia, what you describe as a ragtag army, and it made me wonder, well, who in God's name was in charge of the government?
Well, this was Habyarimana, and
yeah.
And wanted to make sure. You have to understand that there had been a lot of Tutsi incursions from Uganda into Rwanda. So there was tension between Hutu and Tutsi before this started. And there had always been this fear, and it went back to the time when the Belgians had colonized Rwanda. There had always been this fear that the Tutsi were smarter and could outfox Hutu if given half a chance. So the mere idea that the Tutsi were out there and they were thinking about sort of agitating things in Rwanda, it fed on itself.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
Hello. Two questions, if I might. One to the previous caller, and you just spoke to it a little bit, the Belgian colonial influence on the relationship between the Tutsis and the Hutus, if you could speak to the impact there. And second, Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration's turning their back, if you will, on the situation in Rwanda. If you could speak to those things, I'll hang up and drive.
Okay. The first thing I think that we had discussed a little bit earlier had to do with the fact that the Hutu and Tutsi were sort of more of a caste system before the Belgians got there. If you had cattle, you were considered a Tutsi, and if you didn't, then you were considered a Hutu. And after the Belgians got there, they actually passed out identity cards that sort of codified the system. So that meant that you couldn't move between the two groups, and the two groups were sort of artificially divided. And in the end, that created a lot of tension between the two groups, and also it gave the two groups a way to distinguish each other. So if you had you were required to carry a national identity card and it said which ethnic group you were from, then there was no denying what you were, and that ended up being a real problem during the genocide. And the second part of the question had to do with President Clinton during the Rwandan genocide and the fact that the U.S. didn't come in and help. I was actually a White House correspondent at that time during the genocide. And what a lot of people forget is that 6 months before the genocide, a very searing thing happened to the American military, and that thing was the Black Hawk down in Mogadishu. And the American people had seen American soldiers dragged to the streets of Mogadishu, and they wanted to wash their hands of any sort of peacekeeping operation or any operation at all after that. You remember that it was very hard to get U.S. boots into or troops into Bosnia after that. So you can imagine the Rwandan, the Hutu power force who wanted to wipe out the Tutsi, knew that the U.S. was going to be reticent to come in, and they took that to their advantage. And while there's been a lot of blame placed on the Clinton administration for not going in, I do have to say that it wouldn't have really mattered who was in charge at that time. The mood in the country wouldn't have allowed anybody to send troops into Rwanda.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Hi. You know, it's always struck me this what an effect the Holocaust Museum has had in Washington and other places where they have these, and we keep saying, well, never again, and then all this is happening in Africa, and I wish that there was something like that kind of a museum in here in the States, I guess, because we are so blind to all those terrible things. I mean, I remember Idi Amin and how horrible he was, and I think you could fill a museum with those kinds of things. Now, you mentioned something about some kind of a memorial to these people. I'll hang up and ask you just the question about those memorials, and do you think there's any chance that maybe the black Americans would be interested in creating such a thing?
Well, there actually is a memorial in Rwanda, and it was created, as we had said earlier, by Aegis Trust, which is a British foundation. But the problem is, because there are two different, there isn't one version of what happened in Rwanda that everyone in Rwanda agrees with. Instead, there seem to be two very different versions. There's a Hutu version and a Tutsi version. And the Hutu version is, hey, this was a civil war, and the Tutsi were coming to invade, and we were just protecting ourselves, and then it got out of hand. And the Tutsi version is, you tried to wipe us out. And because the Tutsi are now in charge of the government, you can really see much more of a Tutsi whitewash through this particular memorial than something that is sort of moderate or splits it right down the middle. And there are many, many rooms in this particular memorial museum, but there's only one room dedicated to Hutu who actually tried to help Tutsi.
Where is this museum?
It's in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda.
Okay, so it's not here in the States at
no,
all.
No, I'm sorry.
See, it would be good if it were here.
Yes.
Thank you.
There would probably be more people.
Yeah. Let's go back to talk about the media in Rwanda. What's the state of the media today?
Interesting that they have just, in the last sort of 9 months, opened up the only other radio station, private radio station, since RTLM. And this time, RTLM was basically run by Hutu. This time, the radio station is run by Tutsi. And there have been several journalists in Rwanda who've sort of called to attention to corruption or things that the Kagame government has been trying to cover up, and they've either been arrested or they've been expelled or have escaped from Rwanda for fear of their lives.
Hmm. Going back to the media situation in 1994, what was it then? We've talked a little bit about RTLM. There was also this newspaper that I wonder, you know, were they working together, a newspaper, a tabloid called Kangura?
They've never actually been able to prove that they were working together, but they certainly had some sort of symbiotic relationship because they were going after the same audience. Kangura was, if you look at a copy of Der Stürmer, this Nazi anti-Semitic newspaper that was in Germany during the Second World War, mm-hmm. and leading up to the Second World War, and look at Kangura, they look almost identical. And the way the headlines are laid out and the way their stories are written, it's all sort of very breathy and vitriolic. And again, sort of pinpointing one group and saying that they are the reason for the problems that we're having today. In the German case, it was they were blaming the Jews for the problems with their economy and the problems in of unemployment and everything else. And same thing in Rwanda. This newspaper was saying things like, you know, it's the Tutsi's fault that we're having these troubles in Rwanda. It's the Tutsi who are taking jobs away from you. It's the Tutsi who are taking your land.
Yeah. What do you think what's the right approach to people publishing or broadcasting this kind of vitriol?
Well, there actually was a opportunity to block the radio transmission of RTLM because the United States was well aware of what they were saying, and they could have taken a plane basically and flown it over Rwanda and blocked out the transmission. And they decided not to do it for two reasons. The first reason was that it would be too expensive. I think it would be like $1 million a day or something to do that. And in addition, someone at the State Department actually said, well, that would be blocking free speech, and we don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Charleston, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is a terrific program, Celeste. I didn't know the great deal of the facts that your guest has articulated, but my understanding of Western colonialism and colonialism in general is what prompted my call. And I'm sure the book is timely and covers all the bases, but without having read it, do you articulate any sort of future that will stop the colonialist and post and pre-colonial activities, especially now of the West, which has become traditional, and the third and fourth world, you know, suffer every day because of these machinations. And after Bill Clinton fell apart beaten up on the third world, then Mr. Bush comes along and begins to persecute and prosecute all that over again. Do you have any comment about whether or not what the future might be?
I'm not exactly sure I understand the question.
Well, what's the future of humanity? It doesn't appear very, very good to me. Not with the people who have power and the way they exercise it, and the smashing of old cultures and the things you've been describing of genocide. Right now in Iraq, what's happening there? It's the Shia and the Sunnis, and then all around the Middle East, where religion still has a huge part in local cultures and law. That's what I'm trying to drive at. I hope I'm not being too far afield, because I'm sincere in what I'm asking. I mean, how is it that we can continue on this road for much longer?
Well, I tend to be an enormous optimist, and I actually think that we go through these sort of difficult periods in which it seems that everything is sort of the wheels are coming off everything, just so we can go through periods where things are a little smoother. And I unfortunately feel this is one of those difficult periods. I think that we're going to see this issue of a lack of understanding about Islam is going to be the next sort of big thing that's going to hit us. I was really struck by an article in the New York Times yesterday in which they were talking about the Newsweek article and said that the Pentagon had looked at the article and thought it was fine and had okayed it on the merits, on the facts. But it never occurred to them that allowing the article to be published could possibly upset Muslims in Afghanistan or Iraq or in the Muslim world. And that says a lot about our lack of understanding. And I think that's where the sort of opening and hopefulness can come in, is if we begin to have more understanding about these issues.
Mm. And in the end, do you think that article should have run?
I have a, you know, we were talking about it actually in the newsroom. It's hard to tell, because I think it's been very interesting how the White House hasn't openly refuted the article, but has just said sort of on the merits that it was wrong. And what it's made me wonder is, without getting too far afield here, what it's made me wonder is if they didn't actually desecrate the Quran in any of these interrogations, but they desecrated a book that the prisoners thought was the Quran. In other words, had a cover that made it look like it was the Quran, but inside it was, you know, blank pages.
And would blocking, going back to Rwanda, and we've got to wrap up here because we're already straying past our time.
Sorry about that.
Not your fault.
Okay.
Blocking RTLM's broadcast, should that have been done?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. It allowed the Hutu power movement and basically the bad guys in Rwanda to communicate to each other and tell each other where they could find people and kill them. And if they didn't have that power, less people would have died.
Dina, we've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Dina Temple-Raston has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. The book is published by the Free Press. And that interview was from May 18th of this year. The interview we had scheduled for this afternoon with historian Gary May about his book about the murder in 1965 of civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo has been rescheduled, and that will take place July 6th, of course, this year. So next month, we'll talk with historian Gary May. Let's take a look now at what happened on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade today, futures finished like this. July wheat, 345.5. The high, the low at 334. A settlement price at 335. They were down 4 cents for the day. September contract, 356. The high, the low at 344. Settled at $3.45. They were down 3.5 on the day. December contract now, 366.25, the high. The low at 355. Settlement price at 356.5, down 3.25. And the March futures, 376.5, the high. The low at 366. Settled at $3.67.5 for the March wheat. They were down 2.5 cents. May contract, 377.5, the high, the low at 370. Settlement price there at $3.70, and they were down 1 for the day. July corn, 235, the high, the low at 231.5. Settled 232.25, off 3.25 today. September futures, 244.5, the high, the low at 241. Settled $2.42. They were down 3.25. And December contract at 255 high, low at 251.5. Settlement price at 252.5, down 3.5 for the day. And that's for your December contract, the new crop, December for the harvest month. By the way, USDA's yesterday crop progress and crop conditions report showing that the corn crop across the Midwest, with the exception of the state of Illinois and parts of Indiana, was getting better than it was last week, and was just, 2 percentage points behind last year at this time. Of course, last year at this time, last fall, that is, U.S. farmers harvested an 11.8 billion bushel crop. We'll hear from the 5 state statisticians in the top producing states for corn and soybeans, well, mostly for the corn, coming up during the closing market report this afternoon, and about 20 after the hour of 2 o'clock for that part of the report. We'll also talk with John Hester of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana at 6 after the hour. March corn today, 261.75, the high, the low at 258.75. Settlement price there, $2.59, down 3.25. And the May futures, a 264.25 high, low at 261, settled on that low at 261, down 3.5 cents for the day. July futures, 266, the high, low at 263.5, settled 265. They were off 1.75. July oats down 2 cents today, 153.5, the settlement price. The high at 54.75, the low at 51. September contract, 159.25, the high, the low at 156. Settlement price at 158.75. It was off 1 for the day. July contract in the bean pit now. 7.46 high, low at 7.31.5, settled 7.35 at a quarter, down 3.75. August futures, 7.50.5 the high, the low at 7.35, settled 7.39, they were down 5.5 cents. And September futures, 7.56 the high, the low at 7.40, settled 7.44.5, down 5.5 cents. November contracts, 7.64 the high, the low at 7.47. Settlement price at 7.53, they were down 4.5 of the day. And the January futures in the bean pit, 7.65 the high, the low at 7.50.5, settled 7.54.5, off 3 for the day. March contracts, 7.51 high, low at 7.37, settlement price at 7.44, and they finished unchanged. July bean meal, 2.35 the high, the low at 2.30.50, settlement price at 2.31.60, down 80, and the August contract down 110, 2.32.20 for the August bean meal. 231.60 low and a 235.80 high. July bean oil, 25.78 the high, the low at 25.32, settled 25.44, they were down 14, and the August bean oil off 12 at 25.56 with a high of 85 and a low at 25.41 for the day. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Lower day today for livestock prices, the one exception, December lean hogs. August feeder cattle, the high today 109.20, the low 108.05, the settlement 108.55, that down 10. September 108.10, the high 107.10, the low. The settlement 107.55, that down a nickel. October 107.10, the high 106.12.5, the low. The settlement 106.52.5, that down 10 cents. June live cattle, the high today 82.02.5, the low 81.50, the settlement 81.72.5, that down 32.5. August 80.32.5, the high 79.60, the low. The settlement 79.72.5, down 52.5. July lean hogs, 66.35, the high, 65.32.5, the low, the settlement 66.10, that down 15. August, 65.90, the high, 64.80, the low, 65.45, the settlement, that down 35. October, 56.20, the high, 55.55, the low, 55.72.5, the settlement, that down 12.5. December lean hogs, 54.20, the high, 53.75, the low, 54.02.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. In July, pork belly, 64.80, the high, 63.15, the low, 63.75, the settlement, that down 37.5. The Dow is up 9 points at 10,618. The NASDAQ up 7 at 2095. The S&P 500 up a fraction at 1217.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Tall Paul from Seattle, Washington writes, "Dear Dr. Science, all too often I hear a radio or television broadcaster explain that he or she is filling in for a nailing colleague. My question is, what are they nailing, and why?"